You're listening to Radio MD. She's a chiropractic holistic physician, best-selling author, international speaker, entrepreneur, and talk show host. She's Dr. Suzanne Bennett. It's time now for Wellness for Life Radio. Here's Dr. Suzanne.
Earlier this year, the new director of the CDC Center for Disease Control and Prevention, Dr. Robert Redfield, predicted Americans could end the AIDS epidemic in the U.S. within the next 3 to 7 years. Now, this is a huge challenge, considering about 1.1 million people in the U.S. have HIV, and 1 in 7 of them may not even know it. For those who are living with undiagnosed HIV, testing is the first step in maintaining a healthy life and reducing the spread of HIV. Today on Wellness for Life, we have an expert on HIV and HIV testing, Dr. Gavin Clougherty. He is the Director of Infectious Disease Research, R&D for Abbott's Diagnostics. He's one of the top experts in the field of infectious disease diagnostics and conducts groundbreaking clinical studies on diverse hepatitis and HIV strains. Thanks for being here, Dr. Clougherty.
It's my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. Can we really wipe out AIDS in the U.S.? I mean, 3 to 7 years, isn't that really quickly?
You know, I think it is exciting news and an announcement from the CDC that he thinks this is a possibility. And I think you hit the nail on the head with 1.1 million people infected and 15% of them not knowing they're infected. We still have a challenge and we can't take our eye off the ball. But I think what's important for the listeners to realize is that there are very effective treatments out there. It's been a long road over the last, 30, 35 years. From when no treatments were available until now, when you've got highly effective antiretroviral therapies, people who are living with HIV can expect to have a similar life expectancy and overall health as the uninfected population. But the critical part of this is that 15% who don't know that they have HIV will not access that treatment. And they're also the population that might be at most risk of transmitting that infection, that virus, to their loved ones and continuing this spread. So I think if we want to try and end the AIDS epidemic globally, we really need to make sure that everybody who is infected knows their status, and that also we've got to turn off this spigot, if you like, so of new infections. So there are some concerns I would have.
I'm sure of that, you know, and one of the things that I believe young people, any person and young people have, they're afraid to know, you know, they just don't want to know.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And they don't know that these tests are so readily available.
Right. Well, I think there is still the fear plays a role in two different ways. I think there's a fear of knowing the status because they think back to the 80s where it was a death sentence and also a certain amount of stigma that might have been associated with it. But I think there's a population that is not afraid of it anymore because of these highly effective therapies. And those are ones that may be most at risk of getting an infection and transmitting it. So if we think of it, about a third of new infections are among young people aged 13 to 24. So, and many of these obviously won't know that they're infected and they may be engaged in high-risk activity and continuing to drive that epidemic. These are the populations we need to access and try and reach to make sure that, number one, they don't get infected in the first place. And there's simple methods to avoid infection, you know, the use of condoms, anything that will prevent infected body fluids from entering a new host or a new person will stem the tide of new infections. So people who inject drugs, if they have safe needles or clean syringes and they don't share with infected persons, then this will also help reduce the number of new infections. But I think that it's a dual one. Some people are afraid to be screened because they think it might be a death sentence, and others who might realize that treatment is very easy might not really care as much anymore, and that's another worrying trend.
Right. You mentioned about, obviously, we're talking about prevention, preventing right. The spread, condoms, of course. These are the same advice that we've had for 35 years, or however long it's been. It's been right. In the 80s, right? At least we started learning more about this condition in the 80s. And but still, even with that, knowing that we still have the transmission, we still have spread of HIV.
Right. I think that you know, there are other methods that have come into play more recently to try and help prevent new infections. One is called PrEP, which is pre-exposure prophylaxis, and that's basically taking an antiretroviral in advance of a high-risk behavior so that you can prevent that transmission. Another way you can prevent transmissions is by knowing your status, being tested, knowing your status, and then if you're on therapy and the virus is suppressed, which means that the amount of virus circulating in a person's blood is significantly reduced, that dramatically reduces the risk of them transmitting it on to somebody else, up to 90% reduction in the risk. So people who may even be in a relationship with somebody who's HIV positive can avoid becoming infected, both by the use of barrier methods such as condoms and also by taking this pre-exposure prophylaxis. And if their partner is also adherent to their medications and has their viral load suppressed. So it's a really, really encouraging time. The amount of tools that are available to diagnose patients, the amount of tools that are available to treat patients is really great. I've been working on HIV since 2002, so I'm a relative newcomer compared to some of the folks here who've been working at it since before there was a diagnostic test, because Abbott actually launched the very first HIV test back in 1985. So, you know, it's amazing to see the continual innovations that we have here at Abbott from the diagnostics perspective to continue to make the tests better and make them really robust, different approaches to diagnostics, but then hand in hand with the pharmaceutical companies to develop better and better drugs to treat the infections and now also to help prevent the infections. So it's a very encouraging time, but again, reinforce to your listeners, you know, don't be afraid to be tested. If you don't think that you're at risk, the only way to really be sure is to be tested and to know. And that knowledge is very empowering. And there are access to therapy, to these really groundbreaking treatments is very close at hand, and it's easily accessible.
Can we talk a little bit about your testing? Because there's what you're saying, you can test to see if you are positive, but there's also a viral load you're talking about.
Right. So at Abbott, we've got a broad range of tests. So from screening, where you use an antibody, you know, your body's own response to the virus to detect its presence, and also the combination test is also includes the antigen, which is a protein of the virus, so it can directly detect the virus and your body's response to the virus in a very sensitive way. And that's available through, you know, your routine blood testing that would get sent to a centralized lab. But in addition, we have a rapid diagnostics test or a point-of-care test that's also a combination test that incorporates the antibody and antigen detection. And that can be used in a more, like in a physician clinic or in an outreach program or a more decentralized setting. And that then, for monitoring the patient, once you can confirm the test then with a nucleic acid test, which measures the viral DNA or RNA, so it's a direct measurement of the presence of the virus, and then monitor how much of that virus is in the patient's blood. And that's critical to understand if they're responding to the treatment and if they're what we call virally suppressed, so the amount of virus replicating and in the blood is at a sufficiently low level so that you can be confident that the risk of transmission is significantly reduced, the clinical outcomes, so their overall health and the damage that's done to the immune system is reduced so that they can expect to have equal life expectancy and health as an uninfected person, and also that you monitor the viral load to make sure that the virus is not becoming resistant to the treatment, so that the treatment is continuing to work, because the virus is continually evolving in the patient. It wants to survive just like we want to survive, so it is trying to circumvent everything that we will throw at it. This is a challenge for diagnostic tests as it is for treatment, that the virus is evolving all over the world. You've got more than 35 million people infected, and these strains are, you know, they're evolving just like everything else, and they're trying to survive just like everything else. And our tests need to be able to stand up to this challenge. And so doing, we also help the therapeutic side to withstand this viral evolution and stay one step ahead of this virus.
Got it. So just for our listeners to understand, there are three types. That's what we just heard here. The screening, which is like whether you actually have the immune response antibody to HIV. Mm-hmm. And then we've got number two, the antigen, which is like the protein part of the virus. And then number mm-hmm. three, which actually is the DNA. So the DNA right. is a little bit more in more sensitive, detailed information that will help you monitor the growth of it, how well the drugs are, the drugs, if you are on drugs, are working, and then how you can also in the future help and know if you are a candidate that may spread the disease. Isn't that right?
Right. That's right. And we also have one test that I didn't mention that's important. It's a resistance test. So as I mentioned, the virus can become resistant to various therapies. So in the guidelines in the U.S., when somebody is identified as being HIV positive, they would want to understand if the virus they're infected with has any resistance mutations that might impact the drugs they would be put on so that the physician can pick the appropriate drug regimen for them. So kind of almost tailoring the cocktail of drugs they would be on to the person and also to the virus that they're infected with.
Specific immunotherapy is what you're talking about.
Well, this is, again, we were looking at the viral RNA, the viral nucleic acid, to see if it has mutated in such a way that it confers resistance or an escape mechanism to the virus from the drug. So different drugs have different mechanisms of action. As I said, the virus is trying to evade those. So we want to take a snapshot of what the person is infected with and understand exactly what flavor we're dealing with so that you can then make sure he should go on drug A and B and not C because there's a mutation there that will render that drug useless. So you got to stay one step of them.
Right. How many strains of HIV are there? I mean,
there are many. The major, you would stratify HIV into groups. So there's group M, N, O, and P. And M is the majority. So the majority of HIV that drives the epidemic is group M. This is HIV 1, group M. And then N is rarer, as is O. O is a little less rare than N. And then P has only been identified in two patients worldwide. And it's thought to have originated in the gorilla population and come across to humans. And it's only been identified in two patients. And one of them we actually found in our global surveillance program. So we're very proud of that we were able to identify this group P, different virus that came from a gorilla in a person. The really great news that's a testament to Abbott's global surveillance program is that our test worked even on that virus that had just been zoonotically transmitted from a gorilla. So, you know, the virus, even within these groups, which is a major classification, they're subclassified into various strains. And I think we can go up the alphabet, you know, it's ever increasing up to KLM. You know, we've got a lot of different strains of group M HIV. But almost more interesting from an epidemiological point of view and understanding the virus diversity is the phenomenon of recombination. So this is where different strains of the virus can be present in one patient, and then the viral genome can break into parts and recombine with a different virus, with a fragment of a virus from a different virus, and then you end up with a mosaic. So it's not exactly one strain or another. It's what we call a recombinant form. So, and now there are many, many, many of these circulating recombinant forms. And, you know, we're working with collaborators all over the world for the last 25 years to really look for these weird and wonderful viruses. And we've identified so many of these complex recombinant viruses. And we need to make sure that we stay on top of that so that diagnostic tests work no matter where you're from or where you get tested.
Yes, these little critters are shapeshifters and they morph like crazy.
That's a good way of putting it.
I mean, I can just see it the way you're describing. I can visualize and see what these little critters are doing. And you know what? Yeah. That's the beauty of these viruses. They are very, very strange creatures, you know, microbes that we cannot predict, obviously. And, you know, one of the things that I have a question with is, do you believe that even they, if they do shapeshift and they do morph in and they recombine, do you find that the viral intensity and potency of the virus is weakening? And that's the reason, one of the reasons why we are living longer with HIV, and even people are living and dying of other diseases rather than AIDS.
So I think that the fact that people are living longer and dying of other complications other than AIDS is a testament to the drugs and the various interventions and the diagnostics that lead them into that therapeutic sphere. So I think that's really what's driving us living longer with HIV. I think the viral strains, when you look at a virus that's under the pressure of a treatment, it's never as fit as the virus that's wild type. Usually these mutations that they acquire to escape the treatment makes them less fit. But the funny thing about it, again, where, as you said, they're shapeshifters and tricky critters, as soon as you remove that selective pressure, they will quickly revert to the very fit wild type that they were before. So they want to be in a certain configuration. They will evolve to avoid a selective pressure like treatment, but When you take your foot off the gas, they'll bounce back pretty quick.
That's interesting. The reason why I ask this is because when the H1N1 broke out in the South America area, right?
Mm-hmm.
It was super, super strong, you know? And then as it's reaching America, it just kind of like died down in the intensity. So I'm curious if that type of similar behavior of this virus occurs.
So, you know, I think if we're, you know, one more recent one than H1N1 would be if we look at Zika. And I think what we find in a given population is that the people who are going to show the symptoms or the clinical consequences, you know, they're the ones that kind of present themselves at hospitals and different things like that. And so you see those guys. But the broader population can be infected and just not show the clinical symptoms. So, you know, in a given population, you can have most of the susceptible hosts of the virus get infected and resolve an infection like that on their own. And you'll see like in the case of Zika, you were seeing certain neurological manifestations, and you were seeing the problems with baby and gestation. But it's really that it's almost a population game. The mosquito infected everybody, and the ones that were susceptible at the time to having these problems kind of came to the top. And everybody else, now you've got almost a herd immunity. And so for a given amount of time, everybody that was susceptible to that virus has already been infected and now has an immune response. But I would expect over generations, like within a couple of years, maybe 10 years, you'll see a new crop of potential hosts and in the next generation. So you can see this kind of cycle of infection, and then it drops down, and then it comes back, and then it drops down. You'll see that with other pathogens like dengue and other pathogens too. This cycle can happen.
You know, about the Zika, I there's some school of thought that pesticides that were sprayed in those areas, particularly in the Brazil area, they were the ones that were actually causing the microcephaly problem with the infants. Can you touch on that? Is that true? What do you mean? What do you know about it?
Well, it's not an area of research that I was actively involved in, so I wouldn't be really an expert to speak on that. I do think there's a lot of evidence that does demonstrate that the virus was the root cause of the microcephaly in the infected infants, and that's been kind of well demonstrated. I know that this thing of insecticides and the potential chemical root cause was touted, but I didn't really see anything that was very concrete on that other than theory. But there was a lot of evidence that the virus was the root cause of the microcephaly with that virus, or with that epidemic. Sorry.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, nowadays there's so many factors involved, not
right.
just viral, but in environmental issues, that we've got a lot more research to do. I think, Dr. Clory,
we definitely
have a lot more research.
Well, that keeps us on our toes and makes it interesting. You know, we've got one of the interesting area of research that we have here at Abbott is our virus discovery program, and we're trying to actually look into that to try and see what might the next pandemic be. So we continue to use next-gen sequencing, so very highly complex sequencing technologies and metagenomic data analysis and bioinformatics to try and pick out what might be the next viral pathogen or other pathogen that might become extremely important globally. And we want to be ahead of that curve, since we protect and screen more than half of the world's blood supply in the transfusion sense, and also the diagnostic component of what we do. We want to make sure that we're ahead of that as well. The animal kingdom is an amazing reservoir of pathogens, of these viruses and bacteria, and Ebola is a prime example of that. And these things keep popping up, and it's very difficult to get rid of them. It's like whack-a-mole, because they keep popping up because they're in the animal population. They've got that reservoir, but it's also difficult to understand exactly what strain of the pathogen will pop up, because it's, mm-hmm. again, they're all so diverse. So that's a very exciting area that we're working on.
Oh, it must be. I'm a big believer in looking at nature and figuring mm-hmm. out why is it, affecting. I mean, there's a reason why these critters are here. I mean, it's part of the ecology of the planet. And sometimes, right. for whatever reason, it can, of course, it will creep up into the human population. As you said, the gorilla one, that's crazy mm-hmm. to me. Like, wow, that's amazing that you discovered, Abbott discovered through the Global Viral Surveillance Program, which I actually want to talk about before you go. I just want to touch okay. on what is this surveillance program and how did you discover this gorilla strain? What type of a test is it?
So our surveillance program, again, we collaborate with investigators and blood banks and anybody who has an interest in this space and collects blood, basically, to try and screen and find rare variants of these viruses, HIV, viral hepatitis, other pathogens like that. So we would use all of the tools at our disposal, from rapid diagnostic point of care tests to the serology tests or the antibody tests that we described, various molecular tools. We'll use sequencing technologies to try and look at what is present. So if we find a HIV virus, we sequence it to look at the exact code, the ATGC code that it has, and to see how much it varies from other strains of the virus, and to see how much it's changing, and to look for this recombination where the virus swaps DNA between different strains, or if it's completely new from an emerging zoonotic infection. Like I mentioned, from the animal perspective, the gorilla transmission, there's also been transmissions from chimpanzees as well. So the gorilla and chimpanzee populations have contributed a lot to the various groups. So the current thinking is that there was four separate zoonotic transmissions, zoonotic meaning coming from the animal kingdom into humans, that led to the four different groups of HIV. Because these viruses, as you say, in nature, they play a role, or they're present in the animal population. And there are primates who can get the primate version of HIV, and they can have the virus in their body at very high levels, and it doesn't really impact them from a health perspective. So these animals have evolved with the virus, or the virus has evolved with them. It depends on what way you want to look at it. But, it's when these viruses jump from one species to the other that it can have a devastating effect. So when the virus jumps from a chimpanzee or a gorilla into the human population, that's when you can have a significant challenge. Or in the case of Ebola, there's the bats, or it can be a reservoir or various other animals. But even in the U.S., when you've got Lyme disease, it's a tick-borne virus that you are tick-borne bacteria that you get from deer and mice and other things. So it's very difficult to eradicate because it's in that animal population.
I deal with Lyme disease a lot here in California. People think Lyme is from the East Coast, near the Connecticut and New York and those areas, but it's not true. It's all the way across America, and it
right.
is a
it's
chronic
a different,
illness.
Different species of tick, or the ticks spread, and with them they take their pathogens. And I would want one thing to just mention to your listeners, that in the research that we've done here, and quite frankly, we haven't published this, but I'll give your listeners heads up on this, but we did screen samples that were suspected of Lyme, and that they were trying to, you know, that, but they couldn't identify the Lyme, but it was thought it was Lyme. And we found in these patients, and some of them had HIV, and some of them had hepatitis C, and some of them had other pathogens. So, you know, if you go to the doctor and you think you've got Lyme, don't rule out everything else. That just because you got a tick bite or something like that, there may be something else that could be causing the similar symptoms, because that's one of the big confounders, as you know, for a physician, is that many of these pathogens have a similar presentation. You know, the similar symptoms can be, so trying to do a differential diagnosis to figure out exactly what is causing it is can be challenging, and I think don't rule out that it could be something else, like a Hep C or a HIV or something else. So
it's
make sure you have those
point.
Type of conversations with your doctor, and again, consider, you know, HIV screening and testing as part of your routine checkup or whatever, you know, to make sure that you get your, you live life to the fullest and you can basically, you know, reach your full potential.
I agree on that one. Thank you. Gosh, Dr. Clarity, so much great information. I would love to know, it's Abbott, right? Abbott.com is a website. Mm-hmm. We can find out more information. ABBOTT.com. That's where you're going to find all types of information about testing, the global viral surveillance program, and on any new things that Abbott's doing. Thank you again. Great information. And for all the listeners out there today, if you've learned something new and that you want to connect with your friends and family and share this information, please do so. You can go to iTunes and also give us some great feedback. Support is greatly appreciated. Do connect with me on Instagram or Facebook. And if you need any guidance to dig deeper into your chronic health issues, I will work with you on the phone and Skype consultations. So we do this all around the world. Just go to my website, and it's a new one now. We updated it, drsusanne.com, drsusanne.com, for my contact info. Until next time, go out there and live your best life today, full of energy, enthusiasm, and ultimate health and wellness. This is Dr. Suzanne sharing natural strategies on the Wellness for Life show right here on Radio MD. Stay well.